3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. One day after French voters put her in a presidential runoff with centrist candidate Emmanuel Macron, nationalist anti-immigration candidate Marine Le Pen announced that she is temporarily stepping down as the leader of her National Front party so she can run as a candidate for all of France. In what analysts described as a political earthquake in France presidential vote, Le Pen received 21% of the ballot, while Macron garnered 23.8% of the vote. A winner needs an absolute majority, so a second round will be held on May the 7th. Top officials in the Trump administration will hold a rare classified briefing at the White House for the entire U.S. Senate on the situation in North Korea on Wednesday. The briefing comes at a time of growing tensions between the United States and North Korea. A State Department spokesman says North Korea doesn't appear to be scaling back its nuclear ambitions.
What's very clear is that they're pursuing a nuclear ballistic capability and continuing to carry out tests to give them that capability of reaching not just other countries in the region, but possibly the United States. And that is, to put it mildly, a game changer.
President Trump made separate telephone calls Monday to the leaders of Japan and China to discuss concerns about North Korea. North Korea on Tuesday celebrates the anniversary of the founding of its military, a key holiday in the country. There are concerns the communist state will celebrate the holiday with a nuclear test or an intercontinental ballistic missile. For more news, join us at voanews.com. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. The U.S. Treasury slapped sanctions on hundreds of employees of a Syrian research center that Western analysts say develops chemical weapons like those thought to be used by government forces against civilians in Syria's long-running civil war. The website globalsecurity.org alleges that the development of chemical weaponry at the center is secretly aided by Russian chemical experts. The sanctions come 3 weeks after a suspected sarin gas attack in Syria's Idlib province killed at least 87 civilians and wounded more than 300 others. Former U.S. President Barack Obama returned to his adopted hometown of Chicago Monday, urging young people to be activists in their communities. Speaking at the University of Chicago campus, Obama said the lessons he learned 3 decades ago as a community organizer in Chicago has stayed with him.
What is preventing us from tackling them and making more progress really has to do with our politics and our civic life. It has to do with the fact that because of things like political gerrymandering, our parties have moved further and further apart, and it's harder and harder to find common ground.
Former President Barack Obama. The White House said Monday it feels very confident that the U.S. government will not shut down later this week in a funding dispute, even as it echoed President Trump's call for inclusion of money for construction of a wall along the Mexican border that opposition Democrats say they are against. The current spending plan for U.S. government operations runs out at midnight Friday, leaving Trump and congressional negotiators just days to reach an accord on funding priorities through the end of September. Anti-government activists in Venezuela blocked thoroughfares in the capital and several other cities Monday, continuing a fourth week of street demonstrations to press leftist President Nicolas Maduro for new national elections. Maduro, in a weekly address on Sunday, endorsed voting later in the year for mayoral and gubernatorial posts. He said nothing about moving up elections for the presidency. Maduro's term expires in late 2018. And a Haitian politician and former coup leader is facing prison time and a hefty fine after pleading guilty in a U.S. court to conspiring to launder drug money. Guy Felipe took a plea deal Monday, admitting in a Miami court he accepted more than $1 million from drug smugglers while he was a high-ranking official in Haiti. For more news, please join us at voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown reporting here in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Today is World Malaria Day, and three African countries are chosen for a new vaccine trial.
We're very appreciative that GSK, the pharmaceutical company that is developing the vaccine, will provide this free of charge for this pilot. And the vaccine will be assessed as a complementary intervention in Africa.
Dr. Mashidiso Moti is the World Health Organization's Regional Director for Africa. A new experimental blood test diagnoses malaria from other infections. South Sudan Supreme Court judges suspend their nationwide strike. And the status of nationals from three West African countries is in limbo in the wake of U.S. immigration crackdown.
The TPS expires May 21st, 2017. Until it is renewed, we can presume that all of those people on TPS, whether from Liberia or from Sierra Leone or from Guinea, they are deportable.
Gabriel Williams is the Minister Counselor for Information at the Liberian Embassy in Washington. A high-profile United Nations delegation arrives in Central African Republic today, and lawyers for Uganda's prisoner of conscience are going to court today to ask for a bill. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The World Health Organization has announced that trials of a new malaria vaccine will take place in three African countries, Kenya, Ghana, and Malawi. They have been selected for their high prevalence of malaria and strong existing immunization programs for other diseases. The announcement was made ahead of the UN's World Malaria Day today, Tuesday. As Henry Richwell reports, the chosen theme for this year is a push for prevention.
Malaria remains one of the world's deadliest diseases, killing close to 500,000 people every year, mostly in Africa. So the testing of a new vaccine called RTSS has been greeted as a great step forward. It's hoped that 360,000 children will be vaccinated between 2018 and 2020 in Kenya, Ghana and Malawi. The World Health Organization's regional director, Dr. Mashidiso Moeti, made the announcement Monday in Nairobi.
We're very appreciative that GSK, the pharmaceutical company that is developing the vaccine, will provide this free of charge for this pilot. And the vaccine will be assessed as a complementary intervention in Africa that can be added to our existing toolbox of proven preventive diagnostic and treatment measures.
While a malaria vaccine would be an invaluable tool, other methods remain vital in preventing malaria. Dr. Thomas Churcher of Imperial College London uses mathematical modelling to highlight the best way of killing or blocking the main vector that transmits malaria, the mosquito.
Currently, the majority of control is through the use of bed nets, but it's increasing fear that mosquitoes are becoming resistant to some of the insecticide on those bed nets. And so there's a chance that control that works today might not work as well in the future. And so what we need to do is we need new types of ways of killing mosquitoes, new types of bed nets, new types of drugs, new types of vaccines.
Global efforts to reduce transmission have led to a two-thirds reduction in malaria deaths between 2000 and 2015. It's hoped the development of a vaccine will get us one step closer to one day eradicating the disease, says Churcher.
Hopefully, one day we will have a vaccine that's good enough to be that silver bullet. But the current vaccine can do an awful lot, but it is not going to completely halt malaria transmission. And so therefore the recent studies show that it's partially effective and that effectiveness wears off quite quickly over time.
The $50 million trials in Ghana, Kenya and Malawi are being funded through a network of NGOs and global institutions. Far greater investment will be needed to roll the vaccine out globally if the pilots prove successful. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
An experimental blood test can quickly and accurately diagnose malaria from other infections, so treatment of the mosquito-borne illness can be started promptly. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
The symptoms of malaria, which strikes an estimated 200 million people every year, are nonspecific. That means the fever, aches, pains, and chills in the early stages could be mistaken for any number of infections. So researchers want a test that quickly and accurately diagnoses malaria so appropriate treatment can begin, increasing a patient's chances of survival and helping prevent the disease's spread. The blood test, developed by researchers at Stanford University in California, identifies a pattern of immune system activation to determine whether a person is infected with the malaria parasite or a bacterium or virus. It looks for which genes are switched on and off depending on the type of infection. Stanford University medical professor Purvesh Khatri and colleagues helped develop the biomarker test, which was reportedly 96% accurate.
So that's where a test like ours is useful, where you can take a blood test. You do not require an expert technician, and they are more sensitive than the rapid diagnostic tests that we have now.
Khatri notes that test is not very accurate because it looks for a molecule called an antigen, which activates an immune response to a malaria infection.
And the problem with those are that they are not sensitive enough. So treatment tends to be inappropriate, and then it could take a while before malaria is diagnosed.
Khatri's work drew upon data from 40 studies involving more than 3,000 blood samples from patients with various infections. Some were known to have malaria, but there were also other tropical illnesses observed in the studies, including dengue, typhoid, and leishmaniasis. From those blood studies, investigators analyzed the activation of 2,100 different genes, looking for which ones were switched on and off with parasitic, viral, and bacterial infections. They found a group of 7 genes that were expressed in malaria compared to healthy people and those with other infectious illnesses. While the experimental blood test is accurate in diagnosing malaria, Khatri says it might also detect other parasitic diseases researchers have not yet studied, but he says the blood test could be reliably used in cases in which malaria is strongly suspected and confirmation of the disease is needed. Khatri presented his findings at a meeting of the European Congress of Clinical Microbiology and Infectious Diseases just before World Malaria Day this week. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
The special immigration status, known as temporary protected status, given to nationals from 3 West African countries, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, is in limbo in the wake of U.S. immigration crackdown. TPS was first granted to Liberians in 1991 because of the Civil War. Since then, it has been extended by successive U.S. presidents. President Barack Obama extended the TPS last year for 18 months. Now, the expiration date is May 21st, 2017. Part of the reasons for the extension was the Ebola crisis that hit Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. The Department of Homeland Security said last year that conditions in those 3 countries no longer support their designations for TPS. Ambassadors from the 3 West African countries met recently with officials at the State Department, and they were told to prepare their nationals for the possibility the TPS may not be renewed. Gabriel Williams is the Minister Counselor for Information at the Liberian Embassy in Washington.
The purpose of the meeting was to let the State Department know that these embassies, all of us, are receiving, you know, stories from members of our communities regarding how people are being arrested from various points, from work, from wherever, if these people are found not to have, you know, legal paper to be resident here in the United States, they can be deported. So in the wake of these developments, ECOWAS embassies decided to convene this meeting to have clarity on this position.
I'm assuming that the issue of the TPS for people from, say, Guinea, Sierra Leone, Liberia came up. Did you get any indication there's some sympathy in the State Department whether this can be renewed?
Basically, we were told that when a person declared illegal, that is, if you, you know, stay beyond the time that you are legally required to be in the United States, you are living here illegally and you are therefore deportable. So the message to us was to convene and meet with our various communities, send out the message to our respective governments and let them know that members from our communities that are resident here in the United States who are living here illegally, you are deportable. If you committed deportable crimes, you are deportable. Hence, people who are found in that category, they should begin now, you know, prepare for, you know, what may come.
Does this include the temporary protected status people, which you don't know yet whether it's going to be renewed or not?
Well, I wouldn't outrightly say it includes the temporary protective service people, but the TPS expires May 21st, 2017. Until it is renewed, we can presume that all of those people on TPS, whether from Liberia or from Sierra Leone or from Guinea, they are deportable.
Assuming that this is not renewed, given the current climate, well, how many Liberians living here might be affected?
We will be working on the numbers to make sure that we do not make any misrepresentation because, you know, the policies fluctuate. The TPO was put in place to protect people from those three countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea, that came here at the time of the Ebola. Many of these people have left. Some are still here. So in the wake of the developments that are unfolding now, reflective of the U.S. new immigration policies, we are now trying to, you know, look at the records to determine precisely what the numbers are.
So what is your embassy telling Liberians here who might be or who could get affected by any decision in terms of readiness? What can Liberians here do now?
Well, the embassy here, with the guidance of our government, we have been in contact with the community through the community leaderships. For example, the Union of Liberian Associations in the Americas, EULA. At the time of the meeting, we invited the president of EULA to be here to have a sense of what it is, so that we will be able to send precise messages out to our people regarding the need for them to begin to prepare, especially those who fall under these categories, to begin to prepare your power of attorney for how your property, your assets are going to be managed in the eventuality of this kind of situation if they were to be confronted. How their family is going to be cared for. These are very profound decisions that people should begin to make now.
I talked the other day with one of the presidential candidates who indicated to me, James, this will be a tremendous burden on the government if all these Liberians here are made to come back home at once. Given what's happening now, the climate here, have you communicated to the government in terms of preparedness?
There is no question that the embassy has been guided by the government. The president herself has been personally involved in the welfare of the citizens here. And it is because of the intervention of the president and through the effort of the embassy, you know, and some members of the Liberian community and Friends of Liberia in Congress, that you've had a continuous renewal of these immigration programs. So the president has been very much involved. And she has always emphasized the contribution of Liberians in the diaspora, especially here in the United States, the remittances in the hundreds of millions of dollars. You look at our country coming from war and then from Ebola, the reconstruction process, the government cannot do it all. The Liberians here have been contributing generously. So if you take that support away, it creates a challenge.
Gabriel Williams is the Minister Counselor for Information at the Liberian Embassy here in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington today. It's Tuesday, April 25th. Daybreak Africa time is 19 minutes past the hour. South Sudan's Supreme Court justices and judges have suspended their countrywide strike. A spokesman for the justices and the judges, Justice Jerry Romando, says they have given the government 1 week to meet their demands.
To continue dialogue with the presidency, we justices and judges in our General Assembly meeting have decided to postpone our open strike across the country with effect from Monday, 21st of April, 2017 until Monday, 1st of May, 2017.
Last week, judges and justices called on President Salva Kiir to fire the country's chief justice and increase the salaries of all judges across the country. The judges blamed Chief Justice Chan Riak Madut for not addressing workplace issues affecting South Sudanese judges. Justice Raymondo says they are meeting with President Kyr this week to try to reach what he calls a win-win solution.
We are very mindful about the general policy of the country. Dialogue is number one. A strike is not our objective, but it is a process towards the goal. We are undergoing discussion, a serious discussion, and serious meetings since Friday up to today. The committee, even after this meeting, we are going for another meeting, and we'll continue meeting until we arrive to consensus.
The judges say if the talks fail, they will continue with their strike early next month. In Uganda, lawyers for Makerere University professor Stella Nyanzi are going to court today to ask for a bail. Nyanzi was arrested earlier this month and charged with cyber harassment of President Yoweri Museveni and his wife Janet, who is also Minister of Education and Sports for Uganda. Professor Nyanzi had criticized the First Lady on her Facebook page for not fulfilling her campaign promise to provide sanitary pads for schoolgirls. Police spokesperson Emilia Kayima says the case against Professor Nyanzi is an example of Ugandans who misuse the social media. Amnesty International has declared Professor Nyanzi as a prisoner of conscience because she is being held solely for exercising her right to freedom of expression. Nicholas Opio is Professor Nyanzi's lawyer. He says the whole trial is an embarrassment to Uganda.
The lawyers of Dr. Stella Nyanzi have filed an application before the High Court here in Kampala, challenging the proceedings of the Magistrate Court insofar as Magistrate Court refused to entertain an application for bail. The application for revision has been filed before the High Court, and alongside that application is another application for release and bail.
Could you tell us why the lower court has refused to grant bail?
We are unable to understand the reason why the Magistrate Court refused to even hear the bail application, let alone grant it, because once an accused person has appeared before the court, they are entitled to at least make an application for bail. Now, the Magistrate Court refused to hear the bail application in the pretext that it wanted to determine and dispose first the application for the status of mental fairness of the settlement.
The argument she made about sanitary pads, the government or the president or the first lady are failing to provide as they promised. How serious is that? The government said this is a misuse of the social media.
Well, the president, when he was campaigning sometime last year, did make a promise himself that she would provide sanitary pads for primary school going girls, because the dropout rates among young girls in school is so high, and part of the reason is that when they get into their menstrual period, they are unable to stay in school because they have no pads.
Nicholas Opio is the lawyer for Makerere University Professor Stella Nyanzi. He was speaking with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. A high-profile delegation of humanitarian leaders from the United Nations arrives in Central African Republic on Tuesday for a week-long visit to the country. Their visit is meant to draw attention to the pressing humanitarian needs in the country, where, according to the United Nations, 2.2 million people, almost half of the population, survive on aid.
When you have a peak of violence, you have also massive displacement of civilian people. In that displacement, you have needs in terms of shelter, in terms of access to potable water, in terms of medicine. So everything is needed, and also in terms of protection. So when we talk about these new peaks of violence and the new waves of displacement that they engender, it also comes with additional needs and new needs that need to be catered. With these new peaks of violence, we have new needs, while the funding of humanitarian activities, of humanitarian action, has been following a downward trend the last 2 or 3 years. And this year, really, we are at the end of the first quarter of the year, and funding of the humanitarian response plan has reached only, even not 6%, of the $400 million that we need.
Not only do you need to have the resources to get that assistance, but then I imagine once you even have the aid itself, there are obstacles to getting it to the people who need it the most in these rural areas, such as the ones the delegation is visiting this week?
The delegation is going to Power. Power is only one example in Kar. There are many other locations that are bluntly cut from the rest of the country. In addition to Power, I would like to mention the town of Kwi. Kwi, in the western part of Central African Republic, has been cut from the rest of the country since last year, September 2016, after an invasion of armed groups. Following that invasion, the town was really closed. Access was denied to humanitarian actors, so nobody could get there. With advocacy of OCHA, of course, and the humanitarian community, we managed to get access since mid-March. But the presence of the armed group, the attacks they have on the civilians, is really an hindrance to the delivery of humanitarian aid.
I imagine it makes it more expensive and much more difficult because of lack of infrastructure in a place like CAR, which just has almost none, really, outside of the capital.
Exactly. The logistic side also is another challenge that we have to face. We have to find innovative solutions sometimes to get the humanitarian aid to those who need it. Now we are entering the rainy season. This is to say that very soon some areas of Kar will be accessible, but it will be very difficult to access sometimes. Due to the rainy season, roads will be blocked or simply cut.
That was Ye Sena, a spokesperson for the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Bangui, Central African Republic. More than 700 global leaders in business, government, and civil society from 65 countries are meeting to explore the opportunities and challenges offered by e-commerce, with a special focus on developing countries. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the site of this week-long conference in Geneva, hosted by the UN Conference on Trade and Development, known as UNCTAD.
The future of e-commerce could not be brighter. UNCTAD is kicking off e-commerce week with new statistics which show the global size of the market in 2015 reached $25 trillion. UNCTAD Secretary General Mukisa Kituyi urges developing countries to join the action and not be left behind in the e-commerce revolution.
Those countries, populations, and small enterprises which have no presence on a digital platform are not only invisible, but they basically cannot grow, they cannot compete.
Kituyi says his own country of Kenya shows how the danger of being left behind by the digital phenomenon can inspire governments into taking political action. He says 4 years ago, Kenya enacted a new law to provide every school child with a laptop. Since computers run on electricity, he says the government accelerated moves to make this service available throughout the country.
In 4 years, more primary schools have received electricity in Kenya than in the preceding 55 years. So the appetite for digital inclusion with sound policy can trigger investment in infrastructure for other purposes, which had been held back because of low political priority.
E-commerce Week will feature panel discussions on topical issues such as cybersecurity and cybercrime, digital trade, and youth employment in the digital economy. Luminaries, including Jack Ma, founder and chairman of one of the largest global e-commerce businesses, the Alibaba Group, will address the high-level event to offer insight into the transformational power of e-commerce. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The World Health Organization has announced that trials of a new malaria vaccine will take place in three African countries, Kenya, Ghana, and Malawi. And that's it for this Tuesday, April 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. on the internet. You can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.